Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Good evening, everyone. Great to have you here. My name is Peter Tribowitz. I'm a professor in the Department of International Relations and the director of the Fallon United States Center at LSE, which is hosting tonight's lecture. So tonight's lecture is the fifth in our year-long lecture series called America's Changing Role in the World. And the series is premised on the idea that the United States is in the throes of a rethink about its foreign policy purposes and priorities that arguably began before Donald Trump, before Trump's presidency, but has accelerated on his watch, often as the current U.S.-Israel-Iran war indicates, in surprising and unpredictable ways. We very much wanted to get speakers in that had views about what Trump 2.0 was about, what the motivation was, where they were, where the administration was headed. But also, we wanted speakers who could talk about what it meant for either the rest of the world, their part of the world, different regions of the world. And so tonight we focus on Trump and Europe, and we are very fortunate to have with us Dr. Natalie Tocci to give us her take on the direction of travel in Trump 2.0 and its implications for Europe. Natalie is the director of the Institute of International Affairs in Rome, professor of practice at the Johns Hopkins University, SAIS Bologna, and a senior fellow at the Institute for European Policymaking at Bocconi University. She has been a special advisor to the EU High Representative and in that capacity drafted the European Global Strategy and worked on its implementation. She's the author of many publications on topics ranging from European foreign policy to multilateral governance to transatlantic relations to going all the way back to her PhD, conflict resolution. She's a frequent commentator on BBC, CNN, Bloomberg, writes regularly for Politico, Guardian, and others. And last but not least, Natalie's a member of the LSE family because she got her MSc. She got her MSc in development here and then her PhD in international relations. Natalie, welcome home. So actually, as she's transitioning, so the deal tonight is that she'll speak for about 30 minutes or so, and then we will carry on a conversation for a few minutes, and then we will open it to all of you in the theater and those of you online. If you're online, what you'll need to do is just look for the Q&A function. Please provide your name and your affiliation, and for those of you in the theater, you just need to raise your hand. Please join me in giving Natalie a warm LSE welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Peter, for those words. And indeed, that last thing that you said is the most important thing of all. I mean, indeed, you know, when Peter calls, Natalie responds. But when Peter calls and asks her to come to LSE, Natalie responds with joy. So I'm absolutely delighted to be back at school. Thinking about Trump, what Trump means for the world, what Trump means for Europe, I guess the sort of fundamental question is this a structural break or is it indeed temporal and conjunctural? And of course, we may take this question by looking at it from a US angle, is what is happening in the US of a structural or of a temporary nature, Or we can look at this question, as I will do over the next half an hour or so, by looking at the reactions to Trump, and therefore seeing whether we can gauge from those reactions whether indeed we're looking at a long-term or a temporary shift. So beginning with this is only a temporary phenomenon. There are, of course, a number of reasons. Of course, they do begin with the United States that may induce us to think that this is the case, or indeed may induce many European leaders to think that this is the case. Ultimately, presidents come and go, and this one presumably will go and will go, right? At least, you know, if the Constitution is respected, which is a question mark, but if the Constitution is respected, he will go in a, you know, finite period of time. So in, 4 years' time, we may be in a very different world. Added to this, I think it is also fair to say that there are a number of elements that also suggest that there is the beginning of a pushback in the United States. We see this pushback coming from institutions to an extent. Just think about the Supreme Court and its ruling against the emergency economic powers used for the tariffs that Trump imposed. Think about the No Kings marches across the country over the course of many months. Think about the reactions of markets, you know, when Trump oversteps the mark. Essentially, there is significant pushback from the markets, and indeed, that is probably more than any other factor, the one that really does induce the president to taco out, right? So Trump always chickens out. When he does feel the heat from the market, he does take a step back. So fundamentally, for those, and as I said, I think there are many in Europe that do actually think that this is only a temporary phenomenon, which, mind you, does not necessarily mean that they think that they will, and the world and America will go back to what it was pre-Trump. I think that there is a fairly consolidated understanding that in many respects, kind of Biden was the outlier, right? I mean, Biden was the one that had overstayed his time in many ways. But still, even those that think that there is no going back to the United States as it was may still think that Trump as is, and in a sense, America as is a passing phenomenon. Anyway, so for those in Europe that think that this is indeed a temporary phenomenon, basically, what you end up seeing is a number of strategies and tactics which, again, if you think that this is temporary, are actually perfectly rational to pursue. So basically, if you think it is temporary, what you do is you flatter. What you do is you buy time. What you do is you play along to the extent that you can, and what you do is to mitigate when indeed there are certain excesses that generate a number of costs. And if you actually look at what has been happening over the last year, you basically see a lot of this, right? You certainly have been seeing a lot of European flattery. In fact, you have seen a lot of European flattery that has essentially tilted into a lot of European self-humiliation, right? You have seen birth certificates being, given, testifying that Trump is deep down actually a German. You have seen regal invites, breaking all protocol, being sent, thinking about what Keir Starmer has done. You have seen a Giorgia Meloni kind of smiling uneasily when Trump calls her beautiful, right? When she is kind of there trying to present herself as a strong woman. And you have seen Trump being called daddy by the Secretary General of NATO, right? So you have seen a lot of flattery tilting into self-humiliation over the course of last year. And as I said, if you think that this is temporary, there's a logic to the flattery and perhaps even to the self-humiliation. On other issues, what you have also seen is, you know, there may be some things in which we may want to play along with him, because fundamentally what Trump is doing is not necessarily against our interests. So say, for example, Trump manages to strike a ceasefire, quote-unquote ceasefire, on Gaza and a 20-point plan in Gaza. You basically see European leaders that are quite happy to stand behind Trump. Of course, they didn't participate at all in the mediation of this deal, but they're happy to stand behind him as he does his show in Sharm el-Sheikh in order to present this agreement. You basically see them still playing along, for example, if you think about the border peace, to some extent with unease, because, of course, the border peace, which was originally conceived as being something tailored to Gaza, then morphed into some sort of alternative to the UN Security Council. Initially, you basically saw European countries that didn't quite want to participate, but the minute in which they kind of found a way out of this, which was essentially you can be an observer without actually fully participating in, you basically saw many, not all, but many of the European dominoes falling and basically going over to the United States and participating as, quote unquote, observers to the border peace. And then, of course, you've seen quite a lot of playing along when it comes to Iran. I'll come back to this right at the end. But as far as Iran is concerned, going back not just to this war, but to the previous one last summer, you know, you had basically people like German Chancellor Friedrich Merz basically saying, well, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, someone's got to do the dirty work, quote unquote, right? And so if the United States and Israel do something which, yeah, I mean, may break international law, but fundamentally Iran is a nasty piece of work, and therefore we will follow along. So one element that stems from the flattery, the subjugation, the bending the knee, the self-humiliation, kind of, you know, then in terms of action, translates into we play along. On other issues, of course, playing along is not quite as easy. But when it comes to questions such as trade, essentially, again, the action equivalent, the action consequence of the flattery is you kind of try and cut your losses. You try and strike deals that are obviously not ideal. Just think about the Turnberry deal between the United States and the European Union accepting a 15% tariff. Initially, when the UK had struck its deal accepting a 10% tariff, the talk that you heard in Brussels is, this is such a bad deal, we're going to get a much better one, because, of course, we're big, you know. I mean, this is 27 countries. We're going to be able to negotiate a much better deal. And, of course, they were not able to, right? And they were not able to, essentially because, as I said, if you think that this is going to be temporary, you basically think, you know, better to take the short-term pain. Ultimately, there will be a long-term gain. If on top of it, Trump is and maybe create a nexus between the economy and security, and he may actually, if we don't accept this 15% trade deal, may, quote unquote, retaliate not on the economy, but rather on security by abandoning Ukraine, we may actually sort of want to go along for the time being. So flattery translates into cutting losses, mitigating the damage, but fundamentally sort of, again, not quite playing along with conviction, as is the case in the previous examples, as far as the Middle East is concerned, but playing along in a sense with a little bit more of unease, but fundamentally thinking that this is the rational way forward. And then, of course, there have been some issues where we have seen a little bit more of a kind of European standing up. And I would put in this category both Ukraine and Greenland, but I think that even if, and I'll go into how there has been more of a standing up, but I think even when it comes to these two examples, we have basically seen, again, a European approach which has essentially been reading Trump as a temporary phenomenon. What do I mean by this? Ukraine, yeah, there has been more of a standing up at times in which not only, as we know, the United States under Trump has basically kind of folded and has adopted a view on the war in Ukraine, which has basically embraced Russia's view, but when there have been moments, for instance, in which the United States kind of floated the idea that it may actually move ahead in terms of lifting sanctions on Russia even before the end of the war itself, you basically saw Europeans saying, okay, fine, but we will not. There was one moment which kind of struck me, and I think it was in March or April of last year. So it was after the J.D. Vance speech in Munich. It was after the showdown in the White House in which Trump humiliated Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. And right after, there was the constitution of the so-called Coalition of the Willing on Ukraine. And it was on one of the occasions of the Coalition of the Willing meeting, I think in that time it was in Paris. And that was when Trump basically said, that some talks were going on in Riyadh, Trump basically said we may lift sanctions on Russia. And Commission President von der Leyen, present in that meeting of the Coalition of the Willing, basically said, and we will not. So you have seen elements of the sort of standing up. But even on Ukraine, what you have seen a lot more of is that standing up has still come with the let's try and keep Trump on side. Let's try and bring him along. Just think about the inordinate amount of time devoted over the last few months, particularly after Trump back in November came out with his 28-point plan on Ukraine, which was kind of written probably more in Moscow than in Mar-a-Lago. On that, after that shock of basically a plan that was an entirely pro-Russian one, basically what the Europeans did is, rather than saying just no, they started working essentially with the United States, for instance, in terms of developing ideas of security guarantees. And yes, there would be a European reassurance force deployed in Ukraine after a ceasefire was reached, but that would require a backstop of the United States essentially being ready to step in if indeed the need were to arise. And there was genuinely a lot of work, and there still is a lot of work being put into this question. But when you actually kind of scratch the surface and you ask exactly the same people, do you actually think there's going to be a ceasefire? Hardly anyone said yes, right? So you could tell that this entire diplomatic game was more aimed at keeping Trump on side than actually genuinely linked to ending the war in Ukraine, not because they don't want to end the war in Ukraine, but simply because they actually didn't think that there was a chance that Russia at this point in time would actually be driven and motivated to end the war. So you basically see, even on this sort of instance of standing up, it's a standing up while keeping the US on side. And then you have the other example of a sort of standing up, probably even slightly straighter than in the case of Ukraine, and that is Greenland. And Greenland, when the Greenland moment happened, so this was obviously after the attack in Venezuela, when immediately Trump shifted and there you go, I'm going to annex Greenland. And that was a real shock. In some respects, actually, it was an even deeper shock than the sort of flipping 180 degrees over Ukraine. And that was really a moment in which I thought maybe the flattery's over. Maybe they have seen the light, right? Maybe they have understood that actually perhaps not straightening up, you know, to 180 degrees, you know, but still not at 90 anymore. You know, we may be kind of edging towards maybe, you know, 120, 130 or something degrees. So gradually kind of, I thought this was a moment in which we would actually stand up. And as I said, you did see some instances, I'll go back to this in a moment, you did see some instances of this, And yet, even in these instances, you basically saw a knee-jerk reaction, which was, again, that of keeping the United States and keeping Trump on side. Enlarging, particularly in a NATO context, enlarging this conversation and all of a sudden kind of framing it as this is about Arctic security. And this is not really about a US threat to Greenland at all. This is about Russia and China. Now, Russia, frankly speaking, yes, you can make the argument. I mean, Peter, you will tell me, to kind of, you know, frame China today as a threat in the Arctic, a little bit of a stretch, yeah? And it's a little bit of a stretch, particularly when you're actually framing it in this way in order not to talk about the real problem. And the real problem is that you basically have the majority shareholder in NATO, i.e. the United States, threatening another NATO country, i.e. Denmark. So, you know, you basically see sort of all of these examples suggesting that the bulk of the European reaction has been implicitly assuming that this is a temporary phenomenon, right? Now, the question I think that is worth discussing, and this is, you know, also what I'd like to focus on in our discussion later, is do we actually think that this is a temporary phenomenon? What actually makes us think that this is a temporary phenomenon, and what instead suggests that we're talking about a structural shift? To use the words of Canadian Prime Minister Mike Carney, this is a rupture. And going back to Carney and sort of understanding if it is a rupture, what kind of rupture are we talking about? Essentially, what we're talking about is, well, this is, at the end of the day, a broader story about the end of the so-called liberal international order. A liberal international order which was premised upon a liberal leviathan. And the liberal leviathan was the United States of America. And now we live in a world in which we can both say, well, the Leviathan is not really a Leviathan anymore, because we live in a world in which indeed power has shifted, power has diffused. It is no longer a world in which there is and only is US hegemony. It's a world which is more multipolar, tripolar, bipolar, interpolar, nonpolar. We can define it in whatever way we want, but it is no longer a unipolar world. And this probably most agree on. So the Leviathan is no longer there. On top of it, what used to be the Leviathan is no longer liberal anymore, right? And this is the story about the United States itself. Yes, indeed, you know, Trump doesn't last forever. He may think he will, but ultimately, you know, I mean, people, regardless of what happens, you know, in the next presidential election, and if for whatever reason he does end up, at some point Trump will go, right? I mean, biologically speaking. But the point is that this is no longer a story just about Trump, right? I mean, Trump first time round, fluke. Trump second time round, I'm slightly exaggerating here, but he's almost the front man of an operation. I mean, a very important front man, but there is an operation behind it. There is an iceberg of which he was basically just the tip. And that iceberg, as we know, has, you know, many contradictions within it. You know, the sort of techno-fascist libertarian end is not quite the MAGA nationalist populist end. So we know that there are these different souls, or the kind of, you know, unhinged neocon end. So we know that there are these different souls that the iceberg is composed of, but the iceberg exists, right? And so the assumption is that that iceberg will continue to live on after Trump is gone. And that iceberg has and will inevitably affect what is also on the other side, right? I mean, you know, what is contrasting the iceberg will be shaped inevitably by the iceberg itself. So the kind of opposition, the future of the Democrat Party will, you know, the Democrat Party will no longer be what it was in the past, because, you know, sort of, in a sense, you know, government and opposition inevitably, in all contexts, sort of shape one another. So if this indeed is a structural break, because what is happening in the United States is structural in nature, can we actually see any signs at all that Europeans are actually acting upon this. And they may not be acting on it on the surface, but again, you know, going back to the analogy of the iceberg, is there a European iceberg in which structural forces are at play? Now, I think if we want to see this in a kind of positive light or optimistic light, I would say, well, you are beginning to see at least two sets of things that suggest that there is some degree of recognition, perhaps not on the surface, but on a sort of deeper level, that there is indeed a sort of structural readjustment going on in Europe itself. The first, obviously, is the story about defence and European defence. I think this is a story that plays out in different shapes and forms. It is largely speaking, to be honest, a story about national rearmament, both obviously taking place in Northern and Eastern Europe, but to me the big story is actually what is happening in Germany. The Northern and East European rearmament is a product of what is happening next door, i.e. Russia. The German rearmament is, yes, obviously connected to what, you know, the threat coming from Russia, but I do think it is induced very significantly by the underlying reading of what is happening in the United States. And it is significant. I mean, this is, I'm not trying to get into an argument of whether we think this is good or bad, but simply that it is happening, right? I mean, if you think that Germany, by the time we get to 2030, will be spending on defence more than France and the United Kingdom combined. And 2030 is like in 4 years' time, right? Germany will be the third largest military spender in the world. So there is something big which is happening. And again, you know, this can end up in a, in a very different direction, not necessarily a pretty one, but it is real. It is something that is happening. In the same way as I think what is happening is there is a structural change going on within NATO. Talk about a European pillar in NATO used to be kind of academic talk. It used to not be taken very seriously at all. And to the extent that there was a talk, it was never really followed by any action. Now, some action actually is happening, right? There is, again, a sort of realistic prospect, if you talk to NATO folk, that basically the United States, that at the moment provides, let's put the sort of nuclear question to one side, but at the moment provides around half, just under half, of the conventional forces in NATO, will probably, again, over the course of the next 2-3 years, go down and provide around, who says, some say 10%, 15%, 20%, but it's very significant downgrading. You basically already see some decisions being taken with, for instance, two operational commands, joint commands, the one in Norfolk and the one in Naples, being shifted from an American commander to a European commander. So in a sense, there is already a sort of European and NATO story that is developing in practice. And although more marginal, but of course the starting point is a completely different one, there is some real action happening at European Union level, right? Of course, as I said, the starting point is a completely different one for reasons that have to do with constitution and with, I mean, all sorts of reasons that I don't want to get into and that you probably know far better than I do. And yet, exactly given that the starting point was kind of so low or almost non-existent, the fact that you basically now have the European Union spending in joint loans $150 billion on defence is not insignificant. So you basically see that if indeed there is an underlying reading which says this is structural and the structural implication is that there is a rupture, you know, across the Atlantic, which is not simply going to be and cannot be papered over the minute in which Trump leaves office. Europe is in a dangerous kind of continent. There is war going on, and therefore, if Europe has to equip itself to contrast and address the threat coming from Russia without or hypothetically even against, not against the United States, it cannot do that, but basically at least without the United States, you start seeing some movement in this direction, which again suggests that there is an element of recognition that there is a structural break. And then I would say the second aspect, which actually takes us beyond the transatlantic relationship, that suggests that there is an understanding that there is something structural going on, in a sense takes us back to where Mark Carney had left in Davos. I mean, Carney, when he talked about the fiction of the liberal international order being over, when he talked about the importance of taking down the sign of that fiction, basically, he was suggesting not that, therefore, you know, order is irrelevant and law is irrelevant and rules are irrelevant and norms are irrelevant, but rather that there should be a sort of rebuilding of those norms and rules and laws together with others. He talked about the role of middle powers and middle powers basically partnering. In a sense, you can see that the way in which Europe has been, again, reacting over the last year gives us a sense of things moving in this direction. There is absolutely no way that there would have ever been a trade agreement signed between the European Union and Mercosur had there not been the Trump moment. There would have never been, certainly not at this point in time, an agreement between the European Union and India. There would probably not have been much interest at all in opening up a negotiation mediated by the Canadians between the European Union and the CPTPP, the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership. And there probably would have not been the reset, quote-unquote, in the European Union-United Kingdom relationship. So all this is happening, which, you know, we could almost define as the rest of the West with the rest, kind of ganging up in different ways as a reaction of what has been happening across the Atlantic. So you basically see both signals suggesting, you know, that The European assumption is that this is a moment that will pass, as well as signals suggesting that there is a sort of deeper acknowledgement that there is a sort of structural break. Now, the reason why, and on this actually I'd like to end, at this point in time, I personally tend more, in a sense, to the more pessimistic rather than the more optimistic view, although I acknowledge that there are elements, as I said, of both, is that when we actually look at the two sets of things that I described earlier, so on the one hand, this kind of defense moment going on in Europe, and on the other hand, this sort of attempt at developing new partnerships, you see on both counts, yes, an attempt at acting, but an attempt at acting in ways which actually risks abdicating, or Europeans themselves abdicating on norms and rules and laws, right? You see it very clearly, I think, in the defense realm. I mean, I kind of hinted at it earlier. The big story happening in Europe on defense, yes, a little bit on the NATO front, yes, a little bit on the EU front, but the big story is happening at national level, right? And if you, I was sort of, you know, referring to Germany, if you take, for instance, the current German government's approach to Europe and European Union more broadly, you essentially see that there isn't a vision of European integration at all. There isn't a vision of building a more integrated, a more united Europe. Yes, there is a vision of European cooperation, perhaps in different configurations of different member states. And you see that this is really in Europe where most of the energy lies, yeah? I mean, it is about the coalition of the willing on Ukraine. It is about Arctic endurance over Greenland. It is now, for instance, about, you know, the French yesterday proposed a naval operation in the Strait of Hormuz. Madness, huh? Anyway, so you basically see these elements of dynamism, but they're not really aimed at constructing through institutions, be they new or old institutions, something which is united and integrated and rules-based. As I said, it speaks far more to European cooperation than to European integration. And then globally speaking, I would say that yes, indeed, there have been these trade agreements, but to be honest, that is pretty much the only good story that can be told. On most other things, you don't actually see a big effort being made at developing principal partnerships with different parts of the world. You see Europe backtracking on issues like climate, for example. You don't see a sort of strong European contribution to trying to sort of reimagine and redefine multilateralism. In fact, you have the president of the European Commission that in a speech 2 days ago openly acknowledged not just that the international order is gone, but there needs to be a kind of acceptance of it. What shocked me deeply was listening to speeches like that of von der Leyen a couple of days ago. Speeches like the one of Friedrich Merz right after the beginning of the US and Israeli war on Iran, and the speeches of my own Prime Minister, Meloni, in Parliament yesterday, in which two things are being said, one after the other. The first is a recognition that international law is violated. Yeah, good, yeah. Okay, now, in the past, this would have been followed by a condemnation of what are we going to do about this, right? Now, that recognition of the violation of the norm is followed with acceptance. We can't go lecturing people about international law, right? We simply have to accept as is. And this is why, and on this point I'll end, I think that yes, you're seeing some reactions in Europe which are not just, hey, this is a fleeting moment, but that are structural in nature, but they tend to speak far more towards a Europe that in some respects is going in a direction which is not fundamentally different from that of the United States itself. Now, of course, there will be, and there always will be, differences across the Atlantic. But I think it is not a coincidence that on the one hand you have this European abdication on laws and norms and rules and institutions precisely at a time in which nationalism and the far right and populism are growing not just in America but in Europe itself. Which kind of leads me to this kind of twisted conclusion, which is, well, maybe the result of all this, which would be a very dark place to end, and so I want to say it simply to kind of, you know, try and dismiss it. Well, I won't dismiss it. I hope you're going to dismiss it, but I think it is a real risk, is that there is a, in a sense, Marco Rubio vision for the West. And it is we, the West. It is we, the white and Christian and nationalist West, yeah? But it is we, it's a civilizational project, so it's not a story about transatlantic rupture, it's a story about a transatlantic, in a sense, reuniting, but on fundamentally, in fact, radically different values compared to the liberal ones on which it was founded. Thank you very much.
That was great, Natalie. I think you put a lot on the table here. I'm sure there's going to be a number of questions. I thought maybe I would just start by kind of circling back to the first part of the talk where you focused on kind of European leaders appeasing Trump. And on the grounds that Trump was potentially a transitory, temporary phenomenon. So I buy that up to a point. I'm wondering, though, the extent to which it's really also, or in addition, a function of relative power and maybe also a mechanism to be, the capacity to be able to respond. I mean, you know, the EU was created, to use your, kind of metaphor about a hegemon, was created when it was a relatively benign hegemon, liberal, and now it's a predatory hegemon. And so it has a very cumbersome decision-making process that maybe is okay when you're dealing with a liberal hegemon. But if you've got a predator who basically understands that you can kind of play parties off of one another, like inside the EU, it would seem to me that part of this is that what we're seeing, that the reason we're seeing, this is not to endorse it, but we're seeing appeasement, or we've seen it. And even in the case of Greenland, there were, as you point out, there were a couple states, Poland and Romania come to mind, who just weren't all in, that it is, it has something to do with just the sheer distribution of power here. Any thoughts about that?
So clearly there is a real imbalance there. Now, the reason why I don't think it's a sufficient explanation is, firstly, there are real imbalances with other regions of the world, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a real imbalance between the United States and countries in Latin America.
Yeah.
And yet, I think if you take the Latin America, so I don't want to, China's the easy example.
Brazil pushed back.
But that's what I'm saying. So yeah. Brazil pushed back. Mexico, that is like hyper-dependent on the United States, yeah? I mean, Claudia Sheinbaum has demonstrated, in a sense, more dignity than most European leaders have, right? India doesn't have the same relationship, but you have seen, that India, even the Canadians, frankly speaking, have demonstrated, I think, more dignity than most Europeans have, right? So somehow I think the imbalance of power is a necessary but insufficient explanation. To this, I would also add there's an imbalance of power. So what? So what exactly is Trump going to do if you stand up? Well, I could take the argument, you try flattery, maybe it works. Maybe you are going to keep Trump on side on, Ukraine. But the United States no longer provides any military or economic support to Ukraine. I mean, the only, with the exception of intelligence, the only thing that the United States does is have the kindness of heart to allow Europeans to buy American weapons for Ukraine, right? And when it comes to money, I don't think that this is probably going to be a sort of hard sell for Europeans to Trump. So I actually don't think that there is much leverage that the United States has when it comes to, for instance, leverage on Europeans passing through Ukraine. You then take, other examples. I mean, you take the trade example. We bowed down on trade. Mm. Other countries didn't, and they got kind of in the end better deals. I mean, I think the India case is a relevant one here. So, you have some comparative, some parameters there that you can use to sort of reassess a first instinct that you may have had of, flattering, hoping that this was actually the smartest sort of strategy. And then I think you have the Trump tacoing out on Europe, on Europe itself, on the two occasions that we have so far in which there has been, a little bit more of a reaction. Greenland, and let's take the case of Spain now. Mm. On Greenland, what happened? Europeans said no. If you move ahead, Trump, and you kind of threaten to go back on the Turnberry trade deal and impose further sanctions on the seven European countries that had the sort of stomach to stand by Greenland, we, the European Union, will suspend, as is the case, the ratification of the trade deal. What did Trump do? He tacoed out. Mm-hmm. You may say, well, no, it was the markets. Yeah? And you're right. But the markets don't give a damn if Greenland belongs to Denmark or to the United States. Mm-hmm. The markets reacted the way they did because the Europeans responded. And there was therefore the specter of a trade war. Now, if the Europeans had bowed, the markets would have been fine, right? So yes, there is a nexus connecting all this to the markets reaction, to which, as we know, Trump is extremely sensitive, but it's connected to how Europeans reacted. And then you have the Spain case. You know, as we know, now in the context of the war in Iran, Spain said, no, we're not going to allow you to use U.S. bases in Spain. And Trump has threatened embargoes. Have you heard anything else about that? No, right? So, again, a year and, 2 months ago, there could have been, if we had had this conversation a year ago, there could have been a case being made saying, well, who knows, is flattery or is standing up the sort of smartest strategy? But we have the evidence of over a year, and we know what flattery has led to, and we know what standing up, be it European standing up or that of others, has led to. And why don't we just kind of smell the coffee, right?
Different question. So Maloney's made some news recently. There's this New York Times article today, you're quoted in it, where she seems to be putting some distance between herself and Donald Trump, or trying to at any rate. And it's striking. And I suppose the question here is, and this goes to maybe the question about the extent to which Trump is structural or transitory, is, tell me a little bit about, or tell us a little bit about, like, what's driving this? Are they their domestic consideration? I mean, this is somebody who, as you pointed out, basically hitched her wagon to Trump early on. And can we read into this that European leaders or wannabe leaders are starting to see that Trump's a mixed bag or potentially toxic for them politically? And in particular, what does this mean for the right?
Right. So I think that we can, I think two things that may actually sound almost kind of in contradiction, but I think they're actually not necessarily. So one explanation is Trump is turning out to be a liability for the far right. And you've seen different signals of this. I mean, not just Meloni. I mean, just think about, Jordan Bardella and over Greenland, right? Even the AfD in Germany over Greenland. Mm-hmm. So, there is this sense of, we kind of far-right nationalists, we kind of think that sovereignty is important. Okay, fine, Ukraine, who cares? Plus, we're pro-Russian anyway. But, once you start kind of threatening Greenland, it becomes a little bit uncomfortable, right? So there's one element, and then this is also connected to the fact that coming to the Iran war, it's deeply unpopular amongst, Europeans. And, the far right or any other party is interested in, retaining and increasing public support. So if basically you have, 70, 80%, of the population that stands against this, it just kind of feels wrong, even if you may actually agree with it, but it just does, it's just not very smart, politically speaking, to endorse it. So this is, I think, one element of the explanation. A second element of the explanation, and this is why earlier I was kind of talking about, Meloni said two things. She said, yes, this is a violation of international law, and the next sentence after that is, and therefore, I neither accept it nor condemn it.
Mm. Not alone, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But this is the world. So, I'm not surprised at all that this is what Meloni is saying. I mean, she is a nationalist far-right leader. She doesn't exactly have at heart, liberal norms and international law and human rights. Like, this is not what she's about. So it doesn't surprise me that this is what she's saying. I am surprised when I hear the German Chancellor saying pretty much the same thing. right? Because when Mertz said, this is a violation of international law, but this is not the time, you know, this is the wrong framing of the issue. This is not the time to lecture people about international law. Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me that a far-right leader is taking this stance. I'm far more surprised when I hear, you know, Mertz, or, I mean, Starmer, not quite as bad, but kind of, you know, sort of, you know, this sense of acknowledging a norm violation and somehow not taking the next step, which would have been in the past that of condemning it.
Since we're here in the middle of, you know, this war is unfolding, we're, I guess, just shy of 2 weeks, I thought I'd, I mean, you referred to it in your talk, but maybe to push you a little bit or get you to speculate a little bit. You know, most of the focus, understandably, is on the harm and destruction that's taking place in the region right now. But and so it's a very kind of near-term, short-term focus. When you think about it in terms of, let's say, the long-term implications for, we could restrict it to just Europe, to Europe. I mean, what aren't we, like, because we're so focused on the near term, not thinking about kind of longer term?
Okay, so I think a useful comparison to make is to rethink what the European reaction to Iraq was in 2003 and think about the reaction to Iran now. And because I think this tells us a lot about a radically different role of Europe in the world. So Iraq was, on one level, a story, very typical story for anyone working on European foreign policy, of European divisions, right? In fact, there were multiple divisions over Iraq, because there was both divisions in the core, France, Germany against, the United Kingdom, Italy and Spain in favor. It was a story about division between the Europe as it was becoming, of course this was happening as enlargement was taking place, and therefore, you know, US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said this is a division between old Europe and new Europe, and of course it was a transatlantic rupture. So it was like division, division, division. And it was a kind of very typical European story of, oh, European foreign policy doesn't work because we're divided. Okay. Actually, if you look at it through a different angle, it was actually a story also of European identity and European agency. I mean, I would say that Iraq was, despite the UK, Italy, Spain, core Europe, France, Germany was against. And it reflected the sentiment of the vast majority of European publics. You know, remember the, I mean, there are many ways in which, in retrospect, particularly after Ukraine, one can criticize this for, but, you know, remember the appeal that was made by Habermas and Derrida, and it was all about, you know, European identity, and we're soft power and they're hard power. And so it was actually a story about an affirmation of a European identity. If you think about what happened immediately after, well, in fact, just preceding, but then immediately after the Iraq War, was that it actually led to the most significant moment for European diplomacy, which was the creation of the E3/EU+3 framework on Iran, which then led, you know, sort of 12, 13 years later to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. So this was actually, although in our, you know, the sort of first reading of it is division, division, but actually on a deeper level, it was, I think, a story about European identity, and it was a story about European agency. If you think about Iran now you can almost tell exactly the opposite story, right? Because yes, okay, fine, there are divisions, but actually there aren't that many divisions over Iran. You have Spain, in many respects, as an outlier, together with Norway, together with Denmark, no surprise, and Slovenia. But, I mean, it's not exactly core Europe, right? I would say that the majority of countries is, although with different shades, different gradations, but fundamentally The French, the German, the British, the Italian position are not radically different. It is about, maybe this is not great, but we really don't like Iran anyway, not just because of what Iran's doing to its people, but more so than that, because Iran has, because I think the Ukraine war has become the dominant prism through which Europeans understand the world, for very good reasons. I would contest that it shouldn't be the only prism through which we view the world, but it is the most important. But nonetheless, you know, when Europeans, since 2022, when Europeans think about Iran, they don't think about Iran, Middle East. They think about Iran, Russia. And so Iran down, Russia down. Really stupid thinking, because actually Russia up, yeah? In the same way as, you know, Venezuela down, Russia down. This was the thinking. This was fundamentally why also they were reluctant to condemn, right? So actually I would say this is not really a story about European division, but exactly in the opposite way to Iraq, it's a story about where does this leave a European identity? I mean, if we're going to just be kind of MAGA minus, right? Because, you know, we also embrace, you know, we don't embrace raw power, but as von der Leyen told us, we kind of have to accept raw power because this is, the world is big, bad, and ugly. Well, the world is big, bad, and ugly. Where are we? So I think that there's a question of where it leaves a European identity. What are we exactly? And what exactly do we think we can do in this world? Yeah, because I think, you know, it wasn't just that we were lofty about norms in the past. It was, as you were suggesting, because actually it was the comfortable thing to do. We kind of swam in our water. Okay, granted that now the tide is moving in the opposite direction. But how exactly do you think you can survive, right, by simply going in that tide of raw power? And this is why, you know, back to Carney, I think, you know, what I found so inspiring about that speech is that it gave a glimpse of what a different approach might be, which is, yes, acknowledging that the past has passed, but not embracing the end of something and just accepting that therefore the only possible alternative is raw power, but trying to reimagine how these partnerships and these norms can be understood, redefined, you know, upheld in different ways. And that would be, in a sense, the sort of equivalent, you know, the sort of 2006 equivalent of, you know, what had started as the Iran diplomacy back in 2003. Maybe you're not on Iran or on something else, but you don't actually see any seeds of that emerging yet, which is why I fear that, as opposed to Iraq, this war is actually leaving us in a much darker place, both as far as identity and as far as agency is concerned.
On that depressing kind of thought, let me open it up and take questions from the floor.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, let's go back here to the person who's got a tie on.
I wanted to ask...
Like, please introduce yourself. Yeah.
I'm Sam. I'm studying A-level politics. I just wanted to ask, like, in terms of this, like, the argument for this being more of a structural change, like, we've seen Trump and MAGA almost trying to, like, groom and impose a more, like, submissive Europe to replace the kind of liberal democratic one that came before it, like, in terms of politics, economics, and the military. Like, you had, obviously they've fallen out now, but like Musk and like the neoliberal technocrats, like he backed Farage, and then after Vance was in Munich last year, you know, he came and spoke in support of Alternative for Deutschland, AfD, and then after Davos, you know, Rubio came and you got the more like American first, like sovereignist position. So it was like, what do you think of like that Trump and MAGA are trying to like replace kind of European liberal democracy in its entirety and build a new ally.
So hold that thought. Other hands? We'll go right up here to this young lady up in the front here. Do you know Kate? Yeah.
Hi, Kate McNamara. Hi, professor at Georgetown University, visiting at the LSE at the moment. Thank you so much for this fascinating talk. I have to say, when I saw the title, I was expecting a different talk, right? And so I want to kind of push you a little bit on sort of where are we going? And I think one of the hardest things, of course, is, you know, our data points are very, very new, right? When we think about the type of geopolitical change going on and the kind of, you know, the ways in which these different countries in the EU may or may not react, it's very early days yet, even though it did begin, you know, 2016 and so on. And I heard tonight, actually, oh, well, you know, the EU is actually kind of making something of itself to some degree. You talked about defense, you talked about structural change within NATO, and then the whole middle power discussion. So I wanted you to kind of give us a bit of a sort of guideline for thinking about maybe over the next year, over the next 5 years, sort of what are the key things that we should be looking for to understand, is it the making of Europe or is it the unmaking of Europe? So what are the kind of bright red lines that you see that, you would indicate, if not a sort of vision of an integrated Europe, but at least in a practical sense, a building of capacity within Europe, EU and national.
Okay, so that's two big questions, and now we're going to take one online. I'll come to you after.
Thank you. Just to say there are over 220 people watching online from countries including Canada, Ukraine, South Korea, Italy, Germany, France, India, Portugal, Mexico, the US, and the UK. The first online question comes from Anthony Valion, who asks, given China is producing tech and energy solutions for the climate, and given the USA is fueling fossil fuel use and stopping climate efforts, will Europe embrace China more?
Mm-hmm. Can Europe get off of American gas?
Yeah. Okay, wonderful questions. Okay, so let me begin with Sam's question on the on MAGA and the far right in Europe. Okay, so this is what they're trying to promote is fairly clear. I mean, they have told us from Vance onwards. They have written it in the National Security Strategy, and they are doing it, right? I mean, providing a lot of money. A lot of money. Does anyone know that today in Brussels, the most well-funded, well-endowed think tank is called the MCC, Hungarian, and it has a 70 million endowment? I don't think that this is coming from Budapest. Some of it may be coming from Moscow, but I suspect that there are quite a few US sources behind all this, right? So in a sense, they've kind of told us in different shapes and forms. Now, to me, the interesting question is what's behind it? Now, of course, what's behind it is that there's an ideological convergence. I mean, they are kind of, you know, nationalist, socially conservative, anti-woke. I mean, you know, we could anti-migrant. I mean, we could go down the whole list. But I think that there's actually a strategic intent behind all this coming from the United States, which actually makes these far-right parties, movements, governments act as kind of useful idiots, given that they presumably are sovereignists, to someone else, sovereign, quote unquote, or rather I should say imperial project. Because, you know, earlier, you know, you were saying something which is completely right. You know, of course, in the past, the US was a hegemon, but it was a benign hegemon. So, yes, obviously, even in the past, there were, you know, there was differences in the distribution of power, but institutions mattered. Coordination, cooperation, consultation, I mean, these things existed. And they did actually have an impact on, you know, sort of policy and outcomes. Now, the vision that is being pursued is one of empire, right? And you can only create empire in your Western Hemisphere, which you can enlarge, you know, quite a bit, if there is something on the other side of the Atlantic which is divided, which is made of these little antelopes, or perhaps these little fat chicken in the jungle. So if the antelopes group together and in something which is a European Union, which is a something collective, then it's harder to colonize, right? So I think that it is not just an ideological convergence because there's a sharing of a sharing of politics. But I think there's also a foreign policy vision, which is an imperial vision, which is why actually going back to Vance Rubio, so Munich 2025, Munich 2026. I was appalled when everyone stood up after Marco Rubio's speech, because to me it was a sophisticated version of Vance's speech. Vance's speech the year earlier was kind of almost a silly speech, yeah? Because, I mean, you know, to come and to say the biggest threat in Europe is that you don't have freedom of expression. Like, yeah, I mean, it's just kind of silly, right? But Rubio's speech, which was all about we, the white and Christian West, was very much an imperial speech, right? Which gave the illusion of, you know, we're on the same page and, you know, sort of the transatlantic love fest can start once again. But it was, as I said, I think an imperial vision, and these far-right movements are the instruments through which you accomplish that imperial vision. On Kate's question of, you know, what should we be looking for? So I guess I can tell you what I think we can expect and what I think we can't expect, and maybe how we could read this. So I'm at this point in time actually very negative on the European Union. Not only because what is happening on the other side of the Atlantic, but because there is a growing capture within the European Union precisely of these far-right parties and centre-right parties that pursuing what is ultimately a suicidal policy of cooperating with the far-right, thinking that they're going to claw back consent, are actually losing it increasingly to them. And, you know, when I hear words like, I mean, it started off well, kind of competitiveness. Well, good, yeah? And then competitiveness, if you take, you know, the Draghi report, it had lots of really good stuff in it, yeah? So competitiveness, how do you achieve it in European context? You go for a capital markets union. In fact, you go for a completion of the single market. You go for a, you know, significant fiscal instrument. You go for many, many of these things. And then maybe you go even for a little bit of bureaucratic simplification. And that was really a tiny, tiny marginal thing of what, you know, Draghi's agenda was, which was an integration agenda. If you look at implementation over the course of the last year and a half, basically all you see is that deregulation agenda, right? And the alternative majority that is pushing for this is not the majority that had re-elected von der Leyen. So it's not your typical majority between the centre-right and the socialists and the liberals and the Greens, but it's actually an alternative majority between the European People's Party and the far-right groups, right? And the far-right don't give a damn about European competitiveness, right? They are pushing for these omnibus packages, rowing back on climate, rowing back on digital, rowing back, and of course they're being supported by the United States, particularly on both climate and digital, because in a sense, bureaucratic simplification becomes a shield for European disintegration. So that is what I see at the moment, and it's what I'm really worried about in terms of what may come. Now, where do I see, am I therefore all doom and gloom on European collective action? No. I do think that we can expect to see increasingly these groups of different European countries coming together on different issues. Coalition of the Willing on Ukraine, now on Iran, on Greenland. I mean, you can see this. And so looking forward, the question is this going to start being crystallized into something, institutionalized into something? You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that we're talking once again about a European Security Council. This was an idea that was first raised in the context of Brexit. It was, trying to understand after the UK referendum, was there a way of retaining a security link? Anyway, the UK was not interested at that point in time, and so it kind of died away. But now it's back. And I think it's interesting to also ask ourselves, why is it back? And so one sort of answer is, well, because we need to try and kind of formalize the stuff that is happening, because you can't simply kind of jump from one summit to the next, you know, you sort of want to. But I think there's a deeper answer to why this is happening. And I think it speaks about the fundamental inability of existing institutions, both the European Union and NATO, to radically transform themselves. The European Union, yes, it will be doing some defense stuff, and I've been a big believer in this. I mean, I've worked on this a lot. But if you think of it, the European Union is kind of a project built for a different era. It was a project built in and for peace. I mean, it can do some defense stuff, but it will never be the core of what the European Union does. NATO, again, was built. I mean, NATO's DNA is American. Ideologically, strategically, operationally, industrially, I mean, you know, whatever way you look at it, it's American. Yeah, you can do a little bit of a European pillar in NATO. I just don't believe that it's going to radically change the nature of... And so you're left with a problem, that existing institutions that you have are unable, because they were born in and for a different period, are unable to adapt in such a radical way. And so maybe these different coalitions are emerging because of an insufficiency of the existing ones to provide sort of answers. So that's, I think, mainly what I'd be looking for. On the China, the Europe-China climate question, so I think that the difficulty that I think Europeans have today when thinking about China is that they have been used to thinking about China in a triangular way. They have been used to looking at what the United States does and not necessarily agreeing with it and saying, well, you know, we're just going to do a little bit less or a little bit different. They want to decouple, we're going to de-risk, you know. But the North Star was Washington. The difficulty that we have now is that it's not quite clear what the US, I mean, you should be speaking to this, yeah? But what is US policy on China? Mm. Yeah? I mean, you know, one day it's kind of an all-out trade war, you know? The next day it's, you know, your best buddies with Xi.
The G2.
So, right. And so Europeans no longer have that North Star. And so they have to figure out, very difficult, very, very difficult for us, figure out what we think with our own heads, right? And look, you know, there are no easy answers to this, because if we just take the climate energy side of it, it is true that on the one hand, we have a problem of Chinese overcapacities and EVs, and if we want our own green technologies, we need a level of, in a sense, trade defense protection. But on the other hand, it is also true that there is no way that we will be able to decarbonize without China. And so, you know, there are some really difficult choices to be made. But what I think the real difficulty is that we need to figure out these answers alone rather than simply, as I said, triangulating with Washington.
That's great. There was a hand back here. Kind of a blue sweater. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Francesca, and I'm a student at the LSE European Institute. So thank you for this talk. I actually wanted to circle back to the point you made about like European identity and how like between Iraq then and Iran now, this has sort of like changed. Because when I think about it from a very like bottom-up approach, I tend to think, like, I wonder if Europe will always be crippled until like our politicians find a way to like really bring the people onto it. Because as long as we keep electing like populist governments that support Trump or whatever illiberal hegemon is going to come next, can Europe really like push for this identity in these people? And do you think there is a political ability at the European level, but most importantly, a willingness and an attention to do this? Thank you.
Okay. Gentleman in the center here.
Thank you. Phil Woodford. I'm an alumnus of the school. I'm just interested in this, going back to this idea of flattering Trump. And I often think, to what end exactly? You know, to get promises from him? Surely his promises are worthless. And when you look at Ukraine, for instance, there's this idea that a fantasy of kind of French and British troops on the ground in Ukraine, which obviously Moscow would never agree to anyway. But then there's the plea for him to provide a security backstop. If he did, it would be absolutely worthless, wouldn't it? So what's the point?
Right. And we'll take one online here.
Thank you. So this question is from Pallavi Subramaniam. How does the EU and India Trade Pact, the mother of all deals, impact the EU's dynamics with the US?
How does
the EU and India Trade Pact, the mother of all deals, impact the EU's dynamics with the US? Will power shift to this side of the world?
Okay, so identity and the people, how to bring the people on board. Now, of course, the problem is that the people have been voting for these governments. And so the question is, what would make the people stop voting for these parties? And I think that it's as if we have elements or maybe ingredients in a recipe that we're kind of beginning to see, but it somehow hasn't gelled yet in an overall recipe. So what is it that we sense works that comes from not, you know, the far right, populist, whatever? So we can see that when leaders demonstrate some courage, that kind of goes down quite well, yeah? I mean, you know, just think about Mette Frederiksen in Denmark, you know? I mean, elections coming up, she's kind of soaring, you know, in the polls. I mean, who knows what's going to happen, but you can sense this, you know? I mean, when someone stands up, that kind of works, yeah? In fact, Ukraine itself, Zelensky was losing popularity. You know, his standing up to Trump, of course, you know, in different ways, but he didn't, going back to dignity, he didn't lose dignity. I think one would associate, you know, sort of Zelensky and courage. That works with people. So I would say there's a story about courage that, you know, is an important one. I think there's also something to be said about principle. I mean, we could raise the example of Sanchez. I mean, Sanchez, by the way, he is not exactly the most popular politician in Spain, has to be said. But I think that while they may not necessarily like Sanchez, I think that overall, the Spanish public appreciates the fact that on a number of issues, from Gaza to Venezuela to now Iran, he has stood up in a principled way. So I think there's something to be said about principle. I think that there is something to be said about charisma, again, to give in this case a US example. I mean, you kind of need to know how to talk, how to convey. You need to kind of have the sort of the mundane sort of, you know, feel, right? And that is a fundamental importance as well. And then I think that you need to be and come across as being authentic. I've been thinking a lot about this question about authenticity, actually listening to, I've become a real fan, to James Tallarico. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Have you guys listened to James Tallarico?
Yes, interesting combination.
So Yeah, don't you think so, Kate?
Oh, totally.
So for those who don't know, James Tallarico just now won the primaries in Texas, a Democrat, and a very, very, very religious one, right? And you listen to Tallarico, and he talks about the Bible and God a lot, right? But he talks about the Bible and God and kind of then says, you know, Jesus would have been in favor of abortion and in favor of gay rights. So he uses, and you can tell he really believes what he's saying.
He's right? Very progressive at the same
he's
time.
He's hyper-progressive, but, you know, using something that he believes in. And there was, I can't remember what interview, and what's interesting about him is that he's kind of breaking through. I mean, he goes on kind of Joe Rogan shows. I mean, he's kind of breaking through to, you know, youth on the right. Super interesting. But there was, I can't remember what interview I listened to. This was maybe about 4 or 5 months ago. And the interviewer was asking him, how does he manage to kind of break the algorithm? Right? I mean, you know, how does he manage to break through with a message which is actually not a particularly radical message? Yeah. And his answer was authenticity. You don't need to be radical to break the algorithm. You need to come across as actually kind of believing what you're saying. And this is why, and this bit of the recipe is the one which I think we have to probably work on the most, right? Because, you know, for all the talk of what needs to be done, well, whatever, affordability. Yeah. I mean, but it's not exactly that exciting. Yeah. I mean, yes, it's what needs to be done. But somehow that doesn't strike as this hyper-authentic message, which is actually going to enable us going back to, you know, sort of bring back the people to a different place. So I know I'm running out of time. So very quickly, on flattery and worthless promises. Yeah, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And this is why I've really struggled, you know, to kind of pick up the example that you were raising about, you know, Ukraine and the reassurance force and the backstop. And a lot of energy is being put into this. And you ask yourself, why? They can't be so dumb as to think that, you know, anything that Trump kind of signs is worth the paper it's written on. I mean, we're in a situation in which we don't even know if what was written back in the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, you know, is worth the paper that it was written on, right? So forget some sort of backstop to Ukraine. So why are Europeans putting so much energy into it? And this is why the only rational explanation that I can find, alongside the fact that obviously if you're a diplomat and you've been told to work on this, you kind of want to believe that it's meaningful. So there's a kind of personal psychology kind of element to all of this. But beyond that, I think that perhaps at a slightly more, I don't know whether tactical, but at a higher level, there is this sense of, the bicycle needs to keep on moving, you know? We need to keep on this link, we need to keep Trump on side, and yeah, we don't really believe that this is, but this is why I would interpret those moves as being, I would read them more as the sort of buying time, thinking and hoping that Trump at some point will pass. I can't remember the last question. I scribbled something.
What was that? India.
India, EU India. EU India, okay, in kind of economic terms, I mean, this is not EU Mercosur. So EU Mercosur is more significant. EU India is, I think, more a story of potential than a story about the present, right? And so I would actually really read all of these agreements together. You know, it is about, in the space of a year, the EU signing agreements with India, with Mercosur, with Indonesia, opening agreements with a number of other countries. And as I said, this would not have happened without Trump. So, you know, I guess this is also another bit of the answer to Kate's question. You know, if one is to, you know, look at the positive side of things, I think trade is actually one of the rare cases in which we actually can tell a positive story of the last year.
That's a great place to end it. So, Natalie, this is terrific. Thank you.
thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events Podcast on your favourite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.